How are you going to pay for medical school? How are you going to pay off your med school debt when you start practicing? How will you be able to afford a home and some of the comforts you've worked so hard for? Those are the questions we're going to discuss today with an expert in financial planning who focuses exclusively on residents and younger physicians. Welcome to the 293rd episode of Admissions Straight Talk, except it's a podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in," and not only in, but in at the best program for you. While we'll be discussing the financial maze of medical school, the sponsor of today's podcast is Navigate the Med School Maze, a free download where you can learn how to master the admissions aspect of that maze, the maze that leads to medical school. You'll find a link in the show notes to Navigate the Med School Maze, and the show notes again are accepted.com/293. Now to our guest. Ryan Inman is the president and financial planner at Physician Wealth Services, which he runs from Las Vegas, Nevada. He's also the host of the Financial Residency podcast. Both are aimed at medical students, residents, and physicians in their first 10 years of practice. In addition to a bachelor's in accountancy, Ryan has an MBA and a master's in accounting and financial management, personal finance, all from the University of San Diego. Ryan, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's an honor to be here.
Glad to speak with you. Ryan, can you tell us a little about your background and how you began your career in financial planning and advising?
Of course. So as you said, I went to the University of San Diego. I have an undergrad from there and two master's degrees. And I kind of got my first start, I should go back a little bit before that, in what an investment advisor or a financial planner would do. With my neighbor growing up in high school, I was the kid that saved all his money and then begged my mom at 13 years old, which is funny to think about, to open up a TD Ameritrade trading account for me so I could trade stocks. I was that kid. Yeah, I was the nerd. No big deal. And my neighbor was a certified financial planner, and he worked with ultra high net worth clients, think $1 million minimums and up.
Wow.
And I learned kind of a lot about the business from him. And so then when I went to school, I was like, this is what I want to do. And of course, as I come out of, you know, my training and my graduate programs, it was 2008 and the entire financial industry got decimated.
Yeah.
So I ended up starting working for KPMG in public accounting, and then ultimately had gone back to work for that individual doing financial planning. And my wife, I met actually freshman year of college. We've been dating, for 10 years, and now we've been married 5. Mm-hmm. So been together a long time, and some of you are probably scratching your head being like, it took you 10 years to marry a doctor. I'm like, yeah, 10 years to marry a doctor. It's all good. But that's really how I got into advising physicians, is because I saw all of the, you know, all of the stuff that my wife was pitched and her friends were pitched during training. It was, you know, whole life investments and just whole life insurance, and just terrible investment products. And there was a lot of fear and scare tactics trying to sell them things. And I know there was a better way. And so I'd help them all out. And, the employer I was working for, I'd mentioned, had $1 million minimum. So it wasn't like I could bring them on as clients. But as my wife and I started to discuss more important things in life, when do we want kids, how do we want our careers to look, I said, I really want to work with physicians. This is just something I really love doing. All of our friends are physicians, or I should say financial planners as well. I have some nerdy friends, so they get to get tossed in the mix, but this is just what I love doing. And so I'm really happy to be on the show here, talking to, hopefully some pre-meds, and
yes.
So they can kind of arm themselves with some of the financial knowledge before they even get into med school, and hopefully, eliminate some of those big mistakes that I see, physicians make kind of on the back end of this.
Okay. Well, that's kind of my idea behind inviting you on also. you know, young adults are not taught this stuff unless they're business majors. So I thought it would be really useful. Now, you've focused specifically on physicians, physicians in training. Why this focus? Why do they need different advice, let's say, than a young engineer or a young lawyer?
Yeah, absolutely. So one is, like, I've been there, right? So I've got, like, the intimate knowledge of, you know, their pains and struggles and the joys, I should say, at the end here, that come from a career in medicine. You know, I know what it's like to be buried in student debt. Actually, that isn't your own. It's your spouse's. And your spouse makes next to nothing while, you know, sleeping every fourth night in the hospital. So I get it. I've been there. And that is really my main driver on why I only work with physicians. And when I look at how they're different from everyone else, there's a couple things that kind of stand out. So one is they have essentially delayed gratification. They put so much aside to become a doctor. And it's not just a financial thing. It's emotionally, it's, you know, their free time, their social time, who they actually hang out with. You know, they have, you know, from a finance side, you know, a delayed start in earnings, you know, earning, I mean, pennies on off per hour, really. If you look at how much goes into when they're in residency and how hard they're working, and, you know, they take it home. It's not just, oh, I worked, you know, and did my shift and took some, you know, did my notes, and, you know, they come home and they still chart, and that's time that they're not reimbursed. So there's that. And then, you know, I have clients that have put off having a family because of student debt. And, you know, they say that the average physician has about $180,000 of debt. And I think that's false. I look at it, and of course, maybe I have a small sample size here, but my average client has $283,000 of debt.
Whoa.
That's a lot of debt.
Obviously, that's an awful lot of debt. I assume some of that is undergrad student loans also.
Of course. Right. But, you know, you look at that and there's a reason why, you know, they are overwhelmed and they don't know necessarily what they're doing. They're not trained, right? You go through all this training and never take a finance course. I think that's absurd. And then they're expected to run their own practices at some point. I think that's insane. But, you know, the biggest thing, I think, when it's all said and done, is after all this delayed gratification and all the delays that they have, they then experience this insane lifestyle creep or lifestyle inflation. When they first hit that attending salary and, oh, I made, you know, $55,000 as a resident, and now I'm making $340,000 as, you know, an attending, you know, that's an insane amount of money that's coming to them that they've never had before. And so it's like, well, I put off buying a car, I put off buying a house, we put off, you know, maybe not necessarily having kids, but saving for their college in a 529 or whatever it may be. And the lifestyle creep just goes through the roof. And then they get stuck after about 2 to 3 years and go, uh-oh, I've overcommitted. My debts are crazy. My student debt payments finally kicked in. And now I'm stuck. Like I'm essentially working paycheck to paycheck. And most of the jobs coming right out of training, physicians don't enjoy and they end up leaving anyway. So if you end up committing and overcommitting, which is what I see a lot, they can, you know, kind of get stuck. So I think they're very different from a couple standpoints. But really, it's just they put so much time and effort and dedication into what they're doing from their career that everything takes a back burner. And then it all comes due right at the end when they become an attending.
Okay. So I guess both the cost and the length of time involved in training are unique, if or at least distinctive to physicians. You know, the debt tends to balloon, that's for sure. And then the rewards in a way are their own challenge.
Absolutely. I mean, being able to hold back and say, you know, I'm not going to spend all this newly found money that I've, you know, had this carrot in front of me. It sounds terrible to give that analogy, but it really is a giant carrot. You know, you go through undergraduate, med school, residency, maybe even a fellowship. My wife did a 3-year fellowship. You're finally done with training and then you finally get that higher earning and then you just want to spend all of it because you've sacrificed so much.
Right. Okay. So how can you advise pre-med, so they're not yet in medical school. They're still in college or they're doing a gap year. What advice do you have for pre-meds? And we're going to go through a little bit, you know, more advanced also, but what would you advise the pre-med listening to this podcast?
Of course. So, you know, I wouldn't necessarily have all the answers for this, but I can look at it from a financial lens, if you will. Pick the cheapest school that you actually can get into. I look at this and it's like how some of these clients that I have go through and they go to these elite schools in, you know, high cost of living areas, and they come out with massive amounts of debt. And it's hard for me to fathom that a school that costs three times or two times more than another school is really that much more impactful on their career and their education. I felt like my wife, when she was, you know, she went to KU and she obviously had a great education, but I think, you know, she chose in-state tuition. She chose to live somewhat basically at home to save on costs. She could have gone, my wife is brilliant, significantly smarter than I am, and I'm totally cool saying it. She could have gone to so many different places. I mean, Stanford and all these places. She's super smart. But she chose to go to an in-state tuition, cut the cost in half. She chose to live at home. And what that allowed her to do was to not take out so many loans. Then she wasn't having to live off of tons of loans and pay a crazy amount towards, you know, tuition to school. And that decision right there, that one thing, is going to determine like the next 20 years of your financial success, if you will, because mm-hmm. you will pay student debt for a long time if you let it go crazy and you let it blow out of proportion. So that would be my number one thing. The number two thing would be to actually begin your financial journey or your financial education like today, because I can tell you, you will not get it in med school. You will not get it in residency or fellowship if you go. And the only people you really are going to reach out to or have contact with are your peers. And they're in the same boat that you are. They don't know what's going on because they were never trained in it. They were never given the opportunity to study personal finance. So take it upon yourself to go and research. There's tons of great books. There's tons of great blogs. There's tons of great podcasts. It's all free. Maybe books are, you know, 10 bucks, but things that you can afford, and do that early before you start getting into six-figure debt. And then my last thing, and this isn't necessarily for pre-meds, but more like med students, was to pick a, and it kind of goes in the same concept, which is why I'm just going to add it here, is to pick a residency in a low cost of living area. Picking it in a high cost of living area just puts you at a disadvantage. I know different residency programs are, some are better, some are worse. And I'm not saying just choose the cheapest one and go there at, you know, to say, you know, sacrifice your career. But, you know, we did residency in Orange County in California, and that made it significantly harder to not basically get into financial trouble. We were okay because I was working. So maybe the thing would be is to have a spouse that works that can help pay for some of this stuff. But if my wife is on her own and living in Southern California, it would have been really hard just to make rent and, you know, basically pay for very little, you know, food and maybe a little travel or entertainment, but not much, without going into credit card debt. So pick, you know, not only just a school that's the cheapest one you can do to lower your loans, but also when you're getting out of school and you're going into residency, to pick a low cost of living city.
Can you give an example of some of the differences in costs? I mean, I actually can, but I'd like to hear your example. I'll share mine.
Yeah, of course. So I can just share one that's from our personal side here. Sure. So we went and did the training in Orange County and then mm-hmm. did fellowship for 3 years in San Diego. And the cost of rent here in San Diego for a two-bedroom or a three-bedroom house, let's say a smaller house, 1,300 square feet in a decent area of town, not the nicest by far, but one that my wife can go jog in the evening in and I don't feel worried about. Let's say that kind of nice of a place. That type of rent is $2,500. Mm-hmm. If when in my family is actually from Las Vegas, and I can rent a place in Las Vegas, and I'm not saying this is where you should go do training, but I'm just saying, like, you know, cost distinction here is I can, you know, have a 3-bedroom house in a gated area in a nice area of town, probably even 500-600 square feet bigger, and be paying $900 or $1,000 in rent.
That's pretty so good.
It's a big difference in the cost of living. And you look at it, there's a couple of fixed expenses that are going to drive basically, you know, how much you're spending from an expense standpoint on your fixed side. And that one of them is student debt and your repayments. And the other is housing. So if you can have cheaper housing, that means you have to make technically less money in order to sustain your normal lifestyle.
And housing affects the cost of everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you are in a high real estate location, everything costs more. Because, you know, the rent for the stores is more expensive, the employee salaries, you know, whether it's storekeepers or whatever, has to be higher because they're also paying higher rent. My story of difference in cost of living is we're talking to a friend recently, and their daughter lives in West L.A., and she and her husband own a 2-bedroom condo. They're moving to Cincinnati and buying a house for a little less than what he thinks he can sell his condo for, his 2-bedroom condo, but it's going to be, I think, a 4-bedroom, 6,000 square foot house on an acre of land. So, and
big difference.
Big, enormous difference. Enormous difference. But okay, I want to give you a situation that I've made it up, but it's based on experience, okay? And it's also based on, I think, some situations that we've encountered. An applicant is accepted at school A, but really wants to attend school B. B is closer to family, but it's in a much higher cost of living state. Tuition is about the same at both programs. Should the applicant decline the offer of admission from school A, go get a master's to improve her qualifications, and hopefully get accepted to school B? Or should she grab that acceptance, deal with the distance, the cost of living, and get started on med school?
That's an interesting scenario. Mm-hmm. So a couple of things that kind of play out in my head. One is a master's is going to cost money.
Exactly.
So you're going to take on more debt in order to make your CV look better to then get into another school to take on more debt. Right. So you've then got you've got deferred earnings, and it might not be immediately, but every year that you wait is, a year that might be several $100,000 if you're a physician, right? In an earnings.
Opportunity cost.
Exactly. I would assume that if you got into med school and you declined it, that it would actually have a negative effect the next time you apply. So I don't know for sure how that looks. And, you know,
I think it would have a negative. It also would depend on the reasons given for the decline. In general, mm-hmm. if you decline, you're less likely to get into the school a second time around. But again, she didn't really want to go to that school. She wanted to go to school. School A was the one she got into and didn't want to attend. School B was the one she really wanted to get into. That was part of the scenario.
But, yeah, and then the last piece, I guess, thinking on this would be is, like, if it's in a lower cost of living area, like, use the savings to travel home then at that mm-hmm. point.
Right.
And it just going from experience with med school, my wife studied all the time. Like, we were dating long distance, and I was the one traveling pretty much every month to come out and visit her from Orange County or San Diego out to Kansas. And it was nice of her to obviously make time and everything, but, like, she was really busy. So I'd also look at it as you're not going to have a ton of free time anyway.
True. What do you think of some of the public service programs for financing one's medical education?
Well, there's a lot of programs out there. Some of them are state specific, but to talk kind of from a general standpoint, if you're going to go through, your med school, and you're going to come out and you're going to work for you know, you're going to do residency, you're working for a 501c3 there, and you set it up correctly, you're in the right repayment system and options, you're going to, you know, keep track of your qualified payments, which you need 120 of them or 10 years worth, then you're going to actually, in your first year, you're going to have $0 payments that actually count towards your 120. So let's say that was, you know, 12 months of payments at $0. That's 12 of 120 down. Say you're going through it through your residency, and then you're going to become an attending. Could you, in theory, make similar salary? And again, it depends, I should say, on loan balance. If you have a 100K loan balance versus a 400K loan balance, it's going to be very different, especially if you're like my wife and in pediatrics. If you have a $400,000 loan balance and you're making 150 or 175 in, you know, Gen Peds, you're probably going to want to try to figure out how to get forgiveness. And that extra 20 or maybe 30,000 you might make in private practice in the long run would cost you more money having to pay back your debt. So I would take into account your actual, like, size of your balance, the specialty or field you're going to go into, how much you're going to make there. And then I would look at, you know, some certain places you might want to work. If you always want to be in academics, it's a very easy question or answer, I should say, that you should look at PSLF. But really, it's, you know, kind of in general, if you can get through, if you have a, you know, 3-year residency and a 3-year fellowship, you might want to stay in and try to find for the last 4 years a job in the public sector to qualify for that. You're already 60% the way through. But if you decide to go that route, the best advice I have for you is to stay on top of it. The servicers really don't know what they're doing, and they're giving tons of bad advice. I see errors in almost every single client. I have over 50 clients. Almost all of them have an error in their loans, in their descriptions, in their qualified payments, in their work history.
What kind of errors? Give me an example.
Yeah, no, dozens probably, but there's one I've got. So he went to residency; it was 3 years. He did a 3-year fellowship, and what they did was is they said your work history is you had 56 or 58 payments in residency, and you only had 2 payments in fellowship, and now that you're an attending, but he still works for a 501c3, he's got some payments going through there. While technically that is correct in terms of dates, they're not aligning it with the right time periods. So he wasn't in residency for 6 years. He was in residency for 3. So in terms of the timing, they were double counting. And who knows what will happen when he, you know, hits 120 and puts it together. But my guess is there's no forgiveness fairy out there, like, you know, with their magic wand going in, you get a forgiveness on your loans and you get forgiveness. Like, they're going to try to find everything wrong with your paperwork to not give you forgiveness. They're not your friend. They're not trying to do you a favor. It's the program that they're put into. And honestly, I would be very careful on what information you trust and follow. And I would just try to get everything squared away as perfect as you can every year. So file the paperwork every year for your certification, and make sure that the correct dates for the correct institutions, for the correct amount of payments are done. Document everything and save everything.
Okay, great. Sounds like great advice. Now, we're hearing from clients who've already been accepted for the 20 to start medical school in 2019. Members of the class of 2023, and they are probably researching loan options if they haven't already done so. What should pre-meds and med students comparing student loan options be looking closely at?
So it's a tough one to be in general, and I'll look at it from a general standpoint of the best loan you can take out, the best loan you can have is the one you don't take out. So if there's a way to not take out as much in loans, let's say to live off of, right? Because they're all going to take out loans to live off. If you can figure out how to budget or cash flow plan and understand, well, this is how much, you know, my housing is. This is how much it is to eat. This is how much I want to allocate to these things and not go overboard, not take luxury vacations and blow your finances up. I mean, med school and really residency, it's about survival, like financial survival, if you will. And if you, as long as you're not getting into credit card debt or taking out too many loans, because you will have to pay that back and you will have to pay it back with interest. And that's something that they don't really stress or push. And that interest is not cheap and it will
and
come.
And it compounds.
Absolutely. So, you know, when we're looking just at loans and, you know, talking about, you know, tips for med students, that loan that you don't have to take out, that's the best thing you can do for yourself. And I think everyone needs to understand, and there's so much technology out there now that there's almost not an excuse. Time I could maybe see as an excuse or lack of desire, but there's, you know, no one's going to care more about your finances or your money than you. As much as I love my clients, and sometimes I feel like I think I love their situation more than they do, or pay attention more than they do, really it comes down to you. So understanding how to budget and not taking out either too many loans, or if you're in residency, not getting into to crazy credit card debt.
Okay. Now, what, you know, you mentioned earlier that young doctors or certainly residents aren't making much money. Young doctors, they suddenly start actually getting paid significant, you know, fantastic salaries sometimes. Mm-hmm. They're usually in their early 30s, sometimes late 20s, but usually early 30s, mid 30s. They may have, like you, a spouse, children, and they're starting to think about, if they haven't already bought a house, they probably want to buy a house. They may starting mm-hmm. to think about college expenses for their kids, or they may even be thinking, you know, everybody tells me I need to plan for retirement. Mm-hmm. So now they're talking about handling this significant student debt, maybe buying a house, starting to plan for retirement or their kids' education. Like, do you have any guidance or guidelines? I mean, I think, you know, the idea of taking out as little debt as you can to begin with is fantastic. Obviously, that's fundamental. But once you're on the other end, what suggestions do you have then for kind of balancing these different priorities?
Yeah, just to hit on that one point, it sounds fundamental, but the more that I dive into physicians and their finances, the more I hear, well, it was essentially free money, so I just took it. And it's not free money.
It's not free
at all. So it might look free, but it's not. And it's going to come due, and it's going to come due with interest. So that's where, you know, if you address it in the very, very beginning, your problems are going to be a lot smaller when you finish training. So your question basically is, you know, how do we pay off debt versus retirement or a house or some other savings goal, right? So it's debt versus mm-hmm. savings. And that's like the number one question that I get asked. And it's different for everyone.
Okay.
It's different for everyone. Right. And I'm not going to say it depends. I'm going to give you kind of a range, because it's different for everyone. If you've got high interest debt, so if you got credit card debt, a personal loan, maybe you don't have those, but you took out a private loan that's got 9% interest. Those things need to be extinguished, right?
Right.
If you're a resident or new attending, and let's say your company gives a match, you know, the first, you know, 2% that you put in, you know, they'll match dollar for dollar. That right there is going to be your best money invested. So I would actually invest to get the match. And then I would pay down any high interest debt that you have incurred. And I would look at that as maybe 7% and above.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing is then I would try to max out your tax advantaged accounts. So that would be like your 401k or 403b.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can look at your IRAs. And if you're a resident, you can contribute to your Roth directly. You won't phase out. If you're a new attending, you're going to phase out. So you have to do what's called the backdoor Roth in order to get that kind of money in. And then, you know, and that's only $5,500 for this year, $6,000 for 2019. And if you're a new attending, I mean, you're making a couple hundred thousand, you've still got a lot of money to play with. Now your student debt's going to come due, right? You've either been in, you're in some type of income-based repayment, and now your income has skyrocketed. So of course your student loans are going to go up. So always make sure that you think about those. And then it really comes down to how debt adverse are you? Or do you, debt doesn't bother me, I'll pay it off when I can, or are you, kind of up at night thinking, oh my gosh, I need to get rid of my debt? From a mathematical standpoint, I would say anything above 5%, I would be trying to allocate a lot of money to try to eliminate it in as quick a fashion as you possibly can. Some people, though, say, I'm okay with it. I'd like to, kind of do some combination of debt, paying off debt and investing. Totally fine. But, if the higher the percentage, the more you're going to want to get rid of that. There's no guarantees in life. But, when you pay down debt, you're essentially earning that much money back on it when you pay down, let's say, a 6% debt. If I look at it and say, what do you do with the remainder? If there is money left over, which I'd be very happy for you if you just figured this out and you've been budgeting, doing all the right stuff. If you got money left over, then it comes down to what are your other competing goals? Is it a house? Is it saving for the kids? School? How does that look? I will state that as much as I love my kids and I want to help them as absolutely as much as I can, I had to make sure that our retirements were taken care of before I take care of their school. Because I can put debt, as you guys all know, on their education, but I cannot put debt on my retirement. So you have to be a little selfish and make sure that your retirement's taken care of before you start doing other things. So that's pretty much where I'd leave it. It's kind of a back and forth, and there's a lot of variables involved, but mathematically, there's some pretty easy things to say. If you've got X percent of interest, you should pay those first.
Right. Well, I like the way you prioritized it. I had a conversation once with, I think, a potential client, and I found it actually rather scary. She was asking me if there was any kind of payment plan associated with using accepted services. And I said that we do make available to our clients PayPal credit, which means that they can have 6 months interest-free, no payments. I said, but do know that if you miss that 6 months, the interest rate is quite steep. And she said to me, what is it? And I think at the time, it was in the high teens, and it might even have been 24%, but it was in that range. And she said, oh, I can handle that. And I thought, exactly. I thought, okay. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Everyone could technically handle it. It's just, is it wise to do? And the answer is no.
Right.
It's not wise to handle that.
No. What financial advice do you have? Or is there really anything that med students can do we've talked about living in a low-cost state, but once you're in medical school, you obviously have the cost of living that you have. Mm-hmm. You can't work really in any significant way because medical school is so demanding. Is there anything that they can do to be more financially savvy?
Well, aside from some budgeting and cash flow that we talked about and, beginning their financial education, reading books, blogs, podcasts, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I actually do have a couple people that have reached out to me based on the podcast. And they said, hey, look, I love what you're doing. This is my situation. I thought it'd be cool for you to know, like, there are people out there that are doing different things. And one of the examples that I'll give you here is I had a gentleman reach out, and he is in med school. He's a third year. And he said that on his time off, now he's not married, doesn't have kids. So, there's no time commitments there. But on some of his time off, he listens to lectures via audio, and he drives Lyft and Uber. And so he is basically doing that. And he says, when I drive and do Lyft and Uber, whatever he ends up making, that is his play money that he can go out and spend on something that he wants to do while not having to take out loans to do those things. So, not saying, it's a glamorous job or waiting tables or, you know, there's other forms of little ways to make money. But that, you know, it is potentially possible to go do that.
And obviously they have complete flexibility.
Kids. Yeah. And you have flexibility and, you know, so if you don't have time commitment of kids and a spouse, it might be easier for you. If you have the time commitments, obviously you want to spend the extra time with them, and that necessarily wouldn't be the possibility, but that means that the budgeting cash flow concept is that much more important.
Okay. Now, you mentioned, I didn't ask earlier, but I do want to go there for a second. You obviously both dated and were married to a physician in training, a resident, a fellow, mm-hmm. and that poses its own challenges. How did you handle? Do you have advice? This is more from personal experience than from professional experience for significant others of med students, physicians, residents, and fellows.
Without getting myself in trouble.
Yeah, without getting yourself in trouble.
No, she'll listen and chuckle probably, but you know, you've got to be understanding. And that's the thing that was immediately that comes to mind when you asked that question. You have to be understanding that the career is tough. It's long hours. I'm splitting time with my wife between her and her career. And from a spouse perspective, you have to just understand that it's important to them that they're doing everything that they can to help save people, save lives, whatever the specialty field. It's obviously going to be different, but they're doing good and they're helping people. And that you have to understand that the time commitments and, you know, maybe you want more time with them or, you know, hey, there's some really cool thing that we could all go do, go travel here. Oh, you're on call. Great. Now we can't go do that. That was a big one. Oh, every fourth night during residency, you're sleeping in the hospital. That's cool. 25% of the time I'm basically single and just hanging out at the house, you know, wishing that she was with me. So from a personal side, it's a hard thing to do. And the career takes priority over a lot of things. I mean, I've had to move around in my own career and sacrifice some stuff to make sure that she can go through and do her training and make sure everything's good. Example would be during grad school, I traveled every weekend out to go visit her in Kansas to make sure that we kept the relationship alive. Otherwise, we would have never saw each other because she didn't really have time to take that much time to come see me with a couple hour flight in residency. If I wasn't already living there, I would have probably had to move somewhere to continue being with her. We did have to move for 3 years, granted back down to San Diego. So it's, you know, play the smallest violin for me that I had to move to San Diego, but I still had to pick up what I was doing, leave work, and find a new job and kind of put my career in limbo for a little bit while we did fellowship. So there's a lot of sacrifice that goes in that's kind of taken maybe for granted, or I guess not taken for granted, but just you don't really think about. But if you have a spouse and you're living with someone who's going to be a physician or is a physician, like there is a lot of sacrifice that comes along with it, along with taking on a pretty hefty debt load to get that done.
Right. Thank you for that insight.
Of course.
Let's turn to what you do professionally. How do you help physicians in training and their families?
Yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity to speak on it. So I basically say, think of me as like your primary care physician, you know, for your finances. What I do is I help physicians take control over their money to understand how they spend money and where they would like to spend money. I look at, you know, what is your ideal life look like? And I think that's really important to come from. How will you use the money versus how much money do you have or how much money do you make? In all honesty, when I talk to a prospective client, I don't care what they make or what they have. I want to know what drives them. Why did they become a doctor? What are they, you know, what are their plans? What do they want to do? And how can we align the money around their life, not the other way around? We look at, you know, budgeting and cash flow. We look at investments. We look at insurance. Which I don't sell. I'm a fee-only planner, but I still give recommendations and help them set that up. employer benefits. You name it, we look at it when it comes to your finances. And, just having a blast helping people, physicians really, and their families, try to live out their ideal life.
Sounds good. All right. I think we're coming towards the end. Any last pearls of financial wisdom for aspiring doctors?
I would say the biggest mistake that I see physicians make, and I've chatted on a little bit here, is when you finish training and you become an attending, don't let the lifestyle inflation go crazy. Give yourself a raise, if you will, but don't spend everything that you essentially make in your newfound salary or your attending position. Make sure that you do it wisely, you pay down debt, you save, and just be responsible for your finances.
Sounds good. Ryan, thank you so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed our conversation and your very practical approach to financial health for physicians and physicians in training. Where can listeners find your podcast, your free resources, and of course, your financial planning service?
Yeah, anywhere that you listen to this amazing podcast, you can find mine called Financial Residency. And you can learn more about, it's all free education around finances, downloadable guides, podcasts, blogs, all that kind of great stuff at financialresidency.com. I also have a community for the listeners that you can go to financialresidency.com/community and join about 1,000 other physicians and their spouses, take control over their finances. And my fee-only financial planning business, you can find it at physicianwealthservices.com.
Okay, and we'll link to both the free site and the paid site. And I want to mention, one of Ryan's first tips to pre-meds and medical students was just to educate yourself. And you can do that via blogs and podcasts. And clearly, his free site offers exactly that, just a lot of resources for you. So thanks again, Ryan, for a great interview.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on, Linda.
Okay. Listener, you'll find links on the sites just mentioned as well as others, including one on management in medical school and also the military option, which is one way to emerge from medical school debt-free. In the show notes, links to both, again, Ryan's sites and those two sites in the show notes at exhibit.com/293. Check them all out, including our sponsor for today's show, Navigate the MBA Maze. Listener, thank you too for tuning in to this, our 293rd episode. If you found this show helpful, I have a favor to ask. Please share your views on iTunes. There's a link in the show notes to our iTunes page. And if you do leave a review, it really helps us. It helps listeners and your fellow pre-meds. It's much appreciated. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.